Everyone's asleep. Everyone but me. And I can't help feel like I'm doing this all by myself.
Broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and incidentally the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. You can go to the homepage and scroll down a little bit. There's a live stream right there for you, as well as the chat rooms. For the caller line is now open, so you can call in with your views and opinions. 218-339-8525. That's 218. You're writing it down. 8525. Come on, please call in, ladies and gentlemen. Don't have a guest scheduled for today, so we're going to give it to you. And if not, we shall be looking through some mainstream media articles and breaking them down the way we love it. Oh yeah. Cannabis capital proposal for Northland. Oh, this looks like a good article. All right, let's have a read of this then. Cannabis law reformers want Northland. It's, we call it the winterless north. Those people in Canada won't know what I'm talking about. Cannabis law reformers want Northland to trial marijuana liberalization in a bid to increase tourism after the American states of Colorado and Washington voted to legalize the drug. The drug. Drugs. Yeah, everybody loves that buzzword drug, don't they? So, I was talking to somebody about this last night, in fact. And he was like, oh, well, they legalized it, so what? It doesn't matter. They should legalize industrial hemp. And I said, bro, you know how David Icke talks about the totalitarian tiptoe? Well, this is kind of like the libertarian tiptoe. Okay, the door swings both ways. We can get the things that we want step by step and make the world that we wish to have. You know, pretty simple. And you just got to do it step by step. You know, Rome wasn't built in a day. It was destroyed in one, though. Built a But a regional tourism leader doubts relaxing cannabis laws would boost tourism, as claimed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. Now, did they get any evidence supporting that? Let's read on. Colorado and Washington last week voted to legalize marijuana possession for people aged 21 and over. And normal spokesman Abe Gray said New Zealand should do the same to attract more tourists. Mr. Gray said Normal wanted the idea trialed in one part of the country and suggested Northland. Now, when the regional tourism leader doubts relaxing cannabis laws will increase tourism, has he heard of Amsterdam? Everybody's heard of Amsterdam. You know why? Because everybody wants to go there as a tourist to smoke weed. I mean, is this person stupid or something? A million Frenchmen go to neighbouring Amsterdam per year, only with this express intention of going to use marijuana where it's legal. Okay? That's one country that borders it. And that's how many people decide to visit. And you think marijuana tourism might not help. Ladies and gentlemen, think about this. If you offered a trip to New Zealand, and while you're in New Zealand, you were able to get a trip on some weed, I think you'd probably come. My first caller here is in a 701 area code. Dude, what's your first name and what state are you calling from? I don't recognize that area code.
Vinny, hello, Randall Steen here. It's a North Dakota area code, but I'm putting up cell towers in Montana, and not for the Obama phone, thankfully.
Everybody got Obama radiation.
Yep, I know it. I have one bit of scumbuggery that I'd like to report on. I don't know if you're following it. DTCC in New York, the Depository Trust and Clearinghouse Corporation. Apparently, they have $36.5 trillion in bonds and stocks, certificates, and ETFs in their vaults that were in Water Street in New York that conveniently got flooded from Sandy. And now all those paper assets are underwater and possibly not legible. And they say they have digital records to back it up. But I'm hearing talk now that all the gold and silver ETFs quite possibly cannot be solved. Who owns it? It's like the MERS fiasco, but much, much, much worse because, you know, if you remember Jeffrey Kinston said silver's leveraged 100 to 1 in paper assets. So if any of these fighter ETFs in gold and silver are traceable, we're in a world of mess.
So we'd be talking about, instead of a run on the banks, we'd be talking about
a
run on the Smiths.
Yeah, everything that clears through New York Stock Exchange, and likewise, is held in this vault.
Well, what could we do here? Because I was listening to Chris Green and my man from Silver Shield, Silver Bullet, Chris Dwayne. Yeah. I love that, Chris Green and Chris Dwayne. But what we was talking about is that, you know, you really need your hard silver assets, right, don't you? If you got paper, it's worth the paper it's printed on.
Yep, and, absolutely.
And this is one of the reasons why, isn't it?
Yep. Well, they say it in modern money mechanics. The dollar has no value but for what it'll buy. And Alan Greenspan said it in his book. You know, save for the gold standard, there's no way to protect wealth. And then when he was on 60 Minutes, he said the government can always pay any debts it can print. And so put those together, the government can always pay its debts it can steal. And then just last month, a federal court judge in Pennsylvania upheld a jury ruling where an inheritance to a family, the guy back in the 30s, had 10 St. Gaudens coins that weren't confiscated, and the last one on Sotheby's, sold for over $8 million, so that the government confiscated $80 million, and even if it took half, right, that's $40 million that the family gets, $40 million for the government. Well, no, what they're going to do is take it all. And so then if they're not numismatic, what's their argument? Well, then they have to melt them down like they should have been in the 30s, and they'll get, what, $16,000 a coin, or maybe, what's that? $1,600 a coin, so that's $16,000. So they're going to spite this family $40 million simply to get $16,000. Can you answer that? Why? I mean, that's just, the government is out of control, crazy.
Well, was it Greenspan or Bernanke who was asked, something? So he said words to the effect as, we're above the law. Nobody regulates us. We're completely independent of the government. And why is it of any surprise then that they would engage openly in scumbaggery? I think it's because they know they can get away with it.
Oh, quite literally, yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, you look at the Justice Department, the top two Justice Department people came out of lobbying. They're a law firm that was passing legislation to allow the MERS trading. And now they're in Justice Department. And, of course, you know, justice delayed is justice denied. So they just know they're going to get away with it. Everyone, all their fingers are in the right position to play this puppet.
Well, I think the American people and the economy are simply being played by like a two-bit piccolo. And, and more or less, We see so many people dancing to the tune, but at the same time, more people are now coming to the realization of what's really going on here. And I think that the whole phrase ignorance is bliss comes into play here. If you had no comprehension of any of this, you'd be blissful until you got taken away to a FEMA camp. Perhaps that bliss is what we should seek to shatter. Because if people, it's like somebody's addicted to a drug, the drug of ignorance. And, mate, sometimes you do have to lock yourself away in a room and sweat it out and do the shakes and do the vomiting and all those terrible things in order to get this junk out of your system. That junk mostly being just incomplete information, much people walking around believing stuff that they can't even explain, you know?
Yeah. Mate, well, you know, I read it on a bumper sticker. You know, the truth is the truth, even if no one believes it, and a lie is the lie, even if everyone believes it.
I've got this methodology, right? It's like nobody kind of wants to be truthful, essentially, because to be truthful is to be incredibly risky. If you come out and you tell everybody exactly who you are and whatever, if the person's cool, you know, they'll understand and they'll comprehend and they'll go, oh, man, you know, I know you did some bad stuff and whatever, but it's all right, you know, we all make mistakes. But if somebody's a real douchebag, on the other hand, they'll take your one big mistake and make you pay for it for the rest of your life. And I think that's kind of like what the Federal Reserve is. The American Congress made one big mistake, and the entire country's being punished for it for the rest of their lives.
Yeah. Well, let me get your opinion. Do you think? I know 2/3 of the new Tea Party members of Congress already, you know, up spending. But do you think the Republican House, the Republican held House, is going to go through this? Raise the debt ceiling, or are they going to stand on this fiscal cliff? I think they're going to. Well, they know the guns to their head, and they're going to look at their self interest and risk the ceiling.
Well, I think it's like I was watching RoboCop 3 last night with my mate, and it was written by Frank Miller, you know, like Sin City, you know, 300, those kind of graphic novel movies. He wrote RoboCop 3. Isn't that interesting? You know, and the premise of RoboCop 3 is OCP, but Massive Giant Corporation, is using foreign security companies to clear neighborhoods of low-income housing of people so that they can build their new giant project city and what have you, okay? And everybody rises up against them and kind of overthrows them. The stock tumbles and everybody's in debt and what have you. And what I got from that is it really is kind of art imitating life. Just think about this for a moment. Imagine you're in Delta City. It's in the future, and people are all still driving around in gas guzzling cars. A majority of people are out of work, homeless, or whatever. And there's people with guns who are now enforcing the law, and the police are just sick of it, and they're like going on strike and everything like that. And it comes to the point in the film where the police are ordered by these private mercenaries to suit up, get their guns and everything like that, and come and help them evict all these innocent people. And the sergeant takes off his badge, he throws it on the floor, and the CEO threatens him, and he says, look, are you thinking of your family? Are you thinking of your pension? Are you thinking of your job? And he says, yes, I am thinking of them, because I have to face them when I go home. And he walks out. And the police suddenly came on all the sides of the protesters and the homeless and those people who were being subjected to basically a fascist corporatistic diktat. And they all got their guns and they started shooting back against these people and beat them. Okay? And it's just like this. Your life or whatever pension or whatever benefits do you think you're going to get out of supporting the system, they're simply going to take it away from you. And before they've taken it away from you, they'll get you to do things that you know you shouldn't be doing under the threat of taking it away from you. And then they're going to do it anyway. Throw down your badges. You know, quit your jobs. There is much more important thing to be fighting for here than just your next paycheck, I think.
Randy, amen.
Thank you for your call, brother.
Yeah, God bless you.
God bless you, man. Listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. The number to call in is 218-339-8525. 218-339-8525. We'll take your calls after the break.
Alone against your mad, deadly, worldwide, conspiratorial, gangster, computer god communism with wall-to-wall, deadly gangster protection, lifelong sworn conspirators, murder incorporated, organized crime, the police and judges, the deadly, deep parroting puppet gangsters using all the gangster deadly Frankenstein controls. These
hangmen,
deadly gangsters,
the judges and the police, with broadcasting on American Freedom Radio. com. Caller lines are open. You can ring in if you like. The number is 218-339-8525. You can also join us in the chat room at the Vinnie Eastwood Show .com. And I also wanted to mention as well that at the end of the show, pretty much every day, we have a social chat that we do. So if you join us in the chat room right after the shows, we'll give you my Skype name, and we have an actual voice call with listeners from all over the world. And it's been quite interesting because we've had times where people will call in and just talk to each other and what have you, and realize that they don't live too far from each other. And then they go to see that person, and they sit together, and they have some fun, and it's good to be alone. And often people will join the show chat daily because in some cases they don't have other people living next door to them or down the road from them or whatever other kind of truth is that they can chill out with and hang with people of like mind. And that's really, really hard. And so that's part of the reason for the Vinnie Eastwood social network and part of the reason why I do it directly after the show each day on American Freedom Radio. So at about, I think, maybe 2 p.m. New Zealand time, which is 8 p.m. Eastern and 7 p.m. Central Standard Time, 5 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, we start up those social chats. And often the guests that we have on the show will lay over and want to talk with the listeners themselves as well. And it's not being done for professional posterity reasons. These are not recorded. In fact, I specifically request that people do not record them so that they can be completely open without any fear of rumors being spread about or people misinterpreting what they say. It's just a group of people coming together in a room and having an honest conversation without fear or reprimand. It's the way it really should be. And that's what I do in my life generally. I see what's not there and what should be there instead, and I make it happen. I don't sit around and tell people how great I am or the great things that I've done. You just got to really nut up and shut up and get the job done, regardless. There are people out there who are absolutely feeling the pinch right now, socially, fiscally, spiritually, and it's so much of a relief just to know that you're not going through it alone, and to in fact be in contact with other people who are going through the exact same kind of stuff that you're going through. Okay, that's really what it's all about, and it's a real practical thing. Okay, imagine you had no friends. Okay, and you're all alone, your family hates you, and you're talking about conspiracies all day long, and you ain't got nobody to bite back at you and just go, yeah, bro, I know exactly what you're talking about, and this and this and blah, 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 blah. And suddenly a relationship starts to build. It's very useful. I've got a caller in here, and if you'd like to call in too, the number is 218-339-8525, 218-339-8525, and we have the Greek calling in. Greetings.
Greetings, in my case. How are you, Vinny?
Somewhat fabulous, actually. I've had a good weekend off, and I'm coming back, and I'm burning on all cylinders again. It's great.
Oh, that's good. I'm mostly off. I'm worried about when I'm on. But at least I'm worried for the people around me. I wanted to bring up a point, and I don't know if it's a well-known term, but I call it plausible normalcy. And that's what's falling apart right now on all levels of society. An example of plausible normalcy: if you go to a bank and borrow money, you must pay it back. If you are sick, you go see a doctor. If you want to be counseled in the law or need legal advice, go see an attorney. If you want to be educated, go to school. Those are cliche terms that the basis of all those things is the opposite of what people think they are. But to maintain that as the basis of what people think they are, they have something called, or I call, plausible normalcy, because if you do a little research, you'll find out banks don't lend money. Anyone that thinks they owe money to a bank could call up the executive administrative office of the bank, give them all of your account numbers and loan numbers, and they will tell you, no, you don't owe us anything. Doctors obviously have their own agenda from a pharmaceutical companies. You're getting nothing more than a toxic soup or some kind of incompetent procedure that will probably render you hurt more than if you just stayed home and did nothing for it. The schools absolutely teach nothing worthwhile at all other than being able to go and be occupied somewhere as an employee, so on and so forth. So the reality of what these institutions that are the underpinning of any society is beginning to be exposed, because the plausible normalcy of it is falling apart. Another one would be, if you want to know what's going on, go watch this television show called The News. So it's the plausible normalcy that's falling apart.
Well, and I was talking to my friend the other night about university, and he'd never been to university. He'd been to Polytech, and Polytech, you get in there, you start using the computers, they teach you how to use the programs, doing art design and all of that kind of stuff, and suddenly you walk away with a skill set. And Tom, university is relatively different, bro, okay? First of all, you've got books on your back that cost like $160 each, and you've got like half a dozen of them that you carry around on any given day. And the knowledge that they give you, none of it is applicable, okay, because they're all preparing you for a world that doesn't exist. And people get surprised when they come out of university and they go in for their first job interview and the person asks you, have you got any experience? As in, do you know how the real world works? And they go, no, I got no experience, meaning I know nothing about the world. And so you have to start from scratch in a new employment rather than them getting somebody who's already done it, already knows what they're doing, somebody who they don't have to train, somebody who's independent, capable of fending for themselves, somebody who's a valued employee rather than somebody who has, basically no knowledge of how to really make things happen and instead are sitting waiting for instruction the whole time, putting pressure on their instructor. It kind of almost destroys independent thought and creativity and the entrepreneurial spirit, or at least that's what I got out of it. And I didn't develop.
Oh, you're being too kind. You're being too kind. It's really, in reality, it's much simpler than that. The reality of education is very simple. You've heard of the concept of addiction, and when a drug dealer moves into town, he pretty much gives you the initial wares for free just to get you addicted, and then it costs very dear once you are addicted. So they have the kindergarten through 12th grade programs, the free public education, to get the society addicted to being manipulated. And now you have to get your fix. So now it gets real expensive to go to what they call secondary addiction or university. You're being laughed at university. There's a reason why the books are so expensive. It's the same reason someone who's like really strung out and needs a fix will definitely pay whatever it takes to get it. And the act of being manipulated is not recognized as an addiction. But when you understand that the mind has been coupled with this concept of getting education outwardly from an institution, there's a desire to have it. It becomes a form of addiction. And as you go up the ladder, just like with any drug, it gets more expensive. I assure you there is no education of any form, whether useful or useless. And the aspect of experience, when they ask you for experience, for example, could it be possible to be doing the wrong thing for 30 years and have lots of experience in doing something the wrong way?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So when they ask you for experience, it doesn't mean anything either on that respect. So all of this, again, is underpinned by this plausible normalcy. And the plausible normalcy is starting to fall apart. The people cannot understand this as a general whole because they still are mixing plausible normalcy with the reality. The reality of it is, you know, when I hear about people complaining about the economy and it's the bankster, and I'm like, I think the bankers are doing exactly what they should be doing. They're doing nothing more than credit brokers. They broker credit, something called credit. And they get what's called the prime rate. And they also have a bunch of side businesses known as all the alphabet agencies. And that's how they get their side money. But the economy directly the banksters or the central banks are doing exactly what they should be doing. And I assure anyone to do some research and you will find what they're calling the national debt. is actually owed to, and I'm not going to say who it's owed to, but I can tell you exactly it's not the banksters. And you could ask any high-level bankster or central bank affiliate or associate or administrator, that debt is not owed to us. And if you go to any country's treasury website, you will see that the surplus of credit is listed as a liability, and that liability must be insured. And in common terms, they call it a debt, and no one is really comprehending that that national debt is not owed to the banksters. So if it's not owed to the banksters, who is it owed to? Now, if you find out who it's owed to, it's the government, who, or actually the legal operatives of the government are controlling it. If you were to actually settle that debt and give that off, take that credit off the books so it would not be registered as a liability, you would crash the economy because a loaf of bread would be $20,000 in 2 weeks. A car would cost $5 million, and a gallon of gas could be as high as $30,000 if you settled the debt. And people don't understand this. And if you've gotten the hint who the debt is actually owed to, and they cannot give it to who it's owed to because it will render a little bit of a problem for a little while. And to give you a little hint, if you go to, I think it's Zimbabwe, they have $100 billion notes now. You can get a $100 billion note in Zimbabwe. I think it'll get you, like, I don't know, a pair of shoes or something.
So are you saying that the U.S. Owes its money to Robert Mugabe?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm just giving you an example of what happens when you try to get that liability off the books. You'll end up dropping the numerical value, the exchange value of your currency very, very quickly. Now, I'll just go ahead and say it. The money is owed to whoever the credit was gotten from. And every economy that is credit-based is based on the full faith and credit of who? It's people.
Well,
that national debt is owed to you.
That's why it's a debt-based currency, because if everybody loans money thinking that they're being given money, what they're doing is they're actually giving themselves for that money and being labeled with it and being turned into a commodity, basically. When you get a loan, what you're essentially doing is signing on a dotted line to monetize yourself and to turn yourself into an instrument of debt.
Well, what happens, again, for plausible normalcy, the loan document itself is a check that you give to the bank, and the money appears on an account because you've already, everyone around you and yourself supposedly backing it with your full faith and credit. And then they have to bring in a secondary document and a third-party agreement that you got a loan to preserve the plausible normalcy, because just ask grandma or go to school or church, and they tell you, oh, sonny boy, if you borrow money, you have to pay it back. See, people are not evolved enough to understand that everything's already been paid for and we're here to share everything. This is not some weird communistic ideology. This is the truth.
You know, that's funny you should mention that, because that was exactly what I was thinking this morning. You know how World War One, they labeled all this debt onto Germany, allegedly, and then they tried to print all this money that they and they also loaned money from United States to pay back the United Kingdom and France, and the United Kingdom and France were in turn paying back the United States, and then the United States was loaning out the money that they were getting paid back by Britain and France to loan to Germany so that Germany could pay back Britain and France, and it kept going round and round and round in this little money loop. And I was just thinking to myself, you know, there's no actual debt that exists there. It's just a shuffleboard game with no frickin' pieces, okay? It's a blank slate, and somebody's just making it up with imaginary pieces, moving it around. But the problem is people think that it's real, and they give up their real country and their real assets and their real freedoms in order to get these instruments of debt. It's frickin' insane.
Great. Yeah, and also bringing up... sovereign debt is a whole other category, but it's pretty similar, yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you for your call, bro.
Thanks, man.
You know, you got to be suspicious of pretty much everything that goes on. That's what I've started to conclude, man. You know what they say is nothing is as it seems. Well, nothing is as it seems if you're not willing to do any investigation. Because if you know what you're looking at, trust me, in a lot of cases, everything is exactly as it seems. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com, 218-339-8525. Go on in.
Yeah. On December 16th, 1961, the world turned upside down, then inside out, and I was born screaming in America. It was the tail end of the American dream. Just before we lost our innocence irrevocably, when the TV eye brought the horror of our lives into our homes for all to see. I was told when I grew up I could be anything I wanted. A fireman, a policeman, a doctor, even president it seemed. And for the first time in the history of mankind, something new called an astronaut. But like many kids growing up on a steady diet of Westerns, I always wanted to be the cowboy hero. That lone voice in the wilderness, fighting corruption and evil wherever I found it, and standing for freedom, truth, and justice. And in my heart of hearts, I still track the remnants of that dream wherever I go in my never-ending ride into the setting sun.
Yes, thank you. On AmericanFreedomRadio.com. I wanted to quickly cover something that the caller in the first segment was talking about, all these debts and bonds and things like that that were all paper and now been basically flushed due to the flooding after Hurricane Sandy. And here's the headline article, I think it came out of beforeitsnews.com. Did Hurricane Sandy cause $36.5 trillion in damage? Is that not the definition of put all your eggs in one basket case? Moving on. I wanted to continue reading this article here about cannabis in New Zealand and turning Northland into a sort of a tourist destination. Okay, so now the other question is, if a million people go from France to Amsterdam every year to use cannabis legally, then I would stress to believe that probably a large amount of Australians, it only costs like $160 to fly from Australia to New Zealand to have a holiday here. And when you come here, you don't have to purchase visas or anything of that nature. And currently there's no state in Australia where it's fully legalized. I imagine that Australia would be the primary source of cannabis tourism simply by sheer proximity. We also know that there is an enormous amount of adventure tourism, which New Zealand is famous for, where people come from all over the world to bungee jump, hang glide, skydive, go on jet boat rides, etc. I mean, New Zealand is a tourist mecca, and I would think that this would simply be one more tool in the belt of people who would wish to attract more tourists to this country. The reason why it's not going to happen is because the Prime Minister, John Key, is the head of tourism, is the minister for tourism in New Zealand. Okay, simple as that. Not going to happen. Or at least from that perspective. Public pressure, on the other hand, and this is what I've been aware of in the United States situation in Washington and Colorado, is that there has been a extensive campaign, lots and lots of history behind this move. It didn't just happen. And currently New Zealand has a cannabis movement that is more active than ever through history. But again, I wonder when it's going to give. Okay. When this will happen, because if you ask anybody really, in 100 years, do you think cannabis will still be illegal? And most people were just thinking reasonably about it, and they just go, yeah, of course it would. And they say, well, then what are we waiting for? Now, cannabis could be taxed at a higher rate than other goods, and part of the tax is used for drug education and rehabilitation that addresses the danger of unwitting and irresponsible drug use, so that when people – it's kind of like – If somebody spikes your drink with an acid tab and you don't know that you've taken an acid tab and you suddenly fly off the handle and you think that what you're seeing is real and you're just having a total out-of-body experience and stuff like that, it's a remarkably different experience from somebody being a shaman or spirit guide of sorts, giving you an education on it and the things that you will experience so that you're prepared for it in the first place, so that you don't fly off the handle. And if you start to, they're there to course correct. And this is the correct traditional and ancient practice of using substances. Something I believe that was purposely wiped out by the Spanish, by the churches and things of that nature, because they taught people to go outside themselves, whereas religion wants you to have a something that's more powerful than you and have that govern your life rather than you going inside yourself, finding out how the inner workings actually happen and living your life accordingly to how you are supposed to in a very universal flow sense of the word. You know, you have a look at China, the Falun Gong practitioners. They had at one point several million people practicing Falun Gong, which is very much along the vein as I was just expressing, inward journeys and personal development, that sort of thing. You can't have that anymore. Oh, it's just bad. It's evil, you know. And this is what the drug war is really about, is to disconnect us from ourselves. Right, the drugs are still there, and the New World Order makes a heck of a lot more money off these drugs because they're illegal, and because people ain't being properly educated or taught how to use them appropriately only when absolutely necessary. It provokes drug abuse out of a misunderstanding and misapplication. Okay, that's the real problem here. Is education and health effects. That's what. That's why you would want any substance really to be legal and taxed and have any of that kind of stuff sort of given to people who want to. If it's a completely irresponsible society that you have to kind of take care of. And I believe that would be maybe the first step into getting ourselves further along the track to a responsible society. As I said, the kind of like the libertarian tiptoe. You got to get it legal. You got to get it taxed. You got to get it regulated. You've got to minimize the harm to people. And then once people are educated, once people have the harm minimized, then its legal status ceases to be a useful thing. And the taxation, I think, should decrease gradually and eventually end altogether. And a lot of people will be dependent on taxation, and that's really dangerous, because when people are dependent on you to come and do everything for you as a government kind of thing, it makes them easy prey to whatever agenda you wish. And if they have a steady stream of money involved, that's even worse. The government could also save the $500 million a year it's spent on cannabis enforcement and imprisonment. That's just in New Zealand. We're a country of 4 million people, and we spend $500 million a year just on cannabis enforcement alone. That's a head-scratcher, isn't it? You've got to wonder, how many people are dealing, growing, or doing any other type of cannabis-related activity that produces a profit for them currently out of an illegal market. Now, think about all the legal ways that they would actually spend that money. They would be paying their rent. They would be getting milk and bread. They would be going to restaurants. They might be purchasing cars and what have you. And essentially, the government doesn't get a cut of that unless they deal the drugs themselves, which they do. And it's been exposed ad infinitum. You know, that's the real thing here. Even if you're doing an illegal activity and making money off it, you're still actually contributing to the economy by paying for normal stuff. I mean, could you imagine if every single drug dealer and grower in this country that pays their rent through their illegal activities, if they all got kicked out tomorrow how big of a blow that would be to the economy? You know, all these landowners, so they don't have tenants no more. You know, that's what's going on here. And it's a cycle of destruction. And there's nothing inherently bad about trying to make some money and not hurting anybody or not damaging or stealing anybody's property in order to survive an otherwise crime-free life, okay? And there's many, many, many people that I've met, some of which are the kind of dangerous dealing types who would pull a knife on you if you owed them $20. Okay? I have seen this happen right in front of me. Psycho. Okay? Psycho who's only really in it for the money. If you're in it for your family, it's not a problem. I know a mate who, his father grew something along the lines of a couple of thousand plants or whatever during the depression in New Zealand in the 80s after the stock market crash, so he could keep his farm. He paid off his farm and then he stopped dealing. Do you think that it would have been much better had he just abided by the law and had all his assets and everything he'd worked for decades and decades stripped off of him because a bunch of derivatives trading traitors and scumbags with absolutely no conscience or any comprehension of the real effect on real people's lives that cannabis and other forms of drug prohibitions and all of their derivative trading and financial scumbaggery instruments really have. They don't have any effect on these people. They all jump out of the building with a golden parachute and leave everybody else to sat on the sidewalk behind them. They don't really care about art in any way, shape or form. Do what you think is right to maintain what you've got. That's all I'm saying. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com, 2198545. Gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. And I don't know, it's weird being a New Zealander talking primarily with Americans. How about that? Okay, so speaking of Americans, please call in, Americans, 218-339-8525, or if you happen to be in some kind of a foreign country, I think the US code is like 001-218-339-8525 or something of that nature, if you want to bring in from another country, because we're all, you know, we're all living under the same jackboot of the New World Order, aren't we? Something we should all probably contribute to getting it off our backs. Now, going on through this cannabis story, this is kind of like a deep subject for me, having been arrested with 13 grams of weed rolled up for sale before, and then them making it up and saying that I'd made $40,000 and had distributed pounds and all of this sort of stuff. Even after admitting everything, they still make stuff up. You understand that if the law is a lie, those who are recruited to enforce it must lie in order to do so. It's just that simple. Do you want to be governed by liars, thieves, and scumbaggery? Nobody does. But District Whangarei District Councillor Jeroen Jongejans, mate, how, with a name like that, how could you not be part of the cannabis movement, you know? The guy's name is Jeroen Jongejans. Who was also chairman of the Northland Tourism Development Group and a member of the Tourism Industry Association Board. So he's a part of a whole bunch of NWO, COC, frickin' DOD top of scumbaggery anyway. Did not believe cannabis tourism would work in Northland or be what the region wanted or needed. So, do you think that's up for the people to decide or for you as the head of a bunch of organizations that have a conflict of interest should make the call? I think we've figured out what's right. Mr. Jongejans' native Netherlands has one of the world's most liberal cannabis regimes, with small amounts allowed for personal consumption and marijuana sold in the country's coffee shops. Now, here's an interesting statistic for you. You know how many people were smoking cannabis regularly in the Netherlands before legalization? It was about 1 in 8. So between 10-15%, really. And when they legalized it, it went down from 1 in 8 to 1 in 21. It got cut by nearly 2/3. The people who were using cannabis at that time quit because it got legalized. How can that be? You know, I thought when it got legalized, everybody would go out and smoke weed. No. That's just the fear propaganda that they put on you. Cannabis is an interesting thing because everybody does it. Okay, you know, raise your hands if you've tried cannabis before. Yeah. Okay, and if you haven't got your hand up, then raise your hand if you know somebody who has ever used cannabis. And think of anybody you know. And think about whether or not you've even asked them if they've done it. And it comes to the point where you either have done it or know somebody who personally and deeply who has, whether or not you're aware of it. That is a incredible thing. And I asked these questions, you know, to crowds before. You know, raise your hand if you know anybody who has ever used cannabis. Okay, now put your hands down. And now raise your hands if you want to see any of them go to jail. Usually one hand will come up and say, "Nah, you're the one who should be arrested for me." And I go, well, sir, that's correct. I should be arrested because I've broken the law. However, you are the only person in this entire crowd of people with whom agrees with that law. Which means you're a tyrant. Which means you care not about the suffering or the freedoms of others, and are unjustly put in a position where you judge other people according to your own made-up version of reality. Sit down, have a joint, bro, and you'll realize, oh my God, I was just taking life too freaking seriously. That's right. Exactly. If you take everything too seriously, oh my God, how tense do you get? Especially if you ain't getting anywhere. Right. A lot of people think stoners are lazy. I've seen the boys from Normal and the pictures of Mary Jane the Cannabis, 1950s, 50-foot, I think it's like 46-foot bus. It's like a yacht on the road. Rusted out. Not in working order. Looked like the devil had just eaten the World Trade Center and then crapped it out onto a bus. You know, it was awful. It's disgusting, and it took them years and years and years and years of hard work, salvaging parts, finding paint, coming up and giving their own time to make this thing work. And you go Google up Mary Jane the Cannabis, Mary Jane the Cannabis, or the Dactory, and you will see the spectacular job that they did. Do you think somebody who's freaking lazy or frickin' stupid, as the propagandists would have you believe, would be capable of producing anything to that effect, specifically out of the cause of attempting to liberalize the laws between this drug that they use every day. You know? It's a lie. Everything about it is a lie. Now, Amsterdam, this councillor, Mr. Jongi Jan, or it might be Jongi Jan, actually. I don't think they pronounce their J's. You know, like they don't go jogging, they go yogging. Amsterdam is the... Can I ever do a Netherlands accent? I don't know if it's in my repertoire. Let's just try something. Amsterdam is the top smoking capital of Europe with its coffee shops, but I don't think it's lots of people go there just to smoke dope. I don't see any great benefits for tourism in Northland by legalizing or decriminalizing cannabis. Really? So, if you're the dope smoking capital of Europe, and yet you don't think people go there just to smoke dope, and you've got no evidence that people don't go there to smoke, is this not a complete and utter denial of reality? How many people have been to Amsterdam? Okay, just to smoke, you know, it's incalculable. Heaps of people go there. All right? And I got mates who tell me about the time that they went and how cool it was and all that sort of stuff. And they spend a lot of money there. Apparently, a guy who's from there just doesn't realize this. Maybe it's because you're not part of the cannabis community. Maybe it's because you don't know what the frack you're fracking talking about, which is probably why you're a councillor and a member of many administrative boards that tell other people what they can and can't do. Hmm? Is that about right? If you're some douchebag who doesn't know what you're talking about, who wants to boss other people around, suddenly you find yourself in a high position of power where you can still boss people around and not know what you're talking about. These people don't develop any, do they? Mr. Jongian said the Netherlands was also surrounded by many other countries with free access for other citizens from other European Union countries. It'd be a long way to come to New Zealand just to smoke a joint. The region had strategies in place to increase visitors, and cannabis tourism was not one of them. Okay, so that was from the Northland Advocate. So what they've done is they've taken this issue and really, really not kind of brought the full story into it. I mean, I can't do it either, but I know a bit more about it than apparently this reporter does. And new doubts over drug war. This is another article in. Latin leaders call for a review of drug policy after two states legalize cannabis. Okay. A group of Latin American leaders yesterday declared that votes by two American states to legalize cannabis have important implications for efforts to quash drug smuggling, offering the first government reaction from a region frustrated with the United States-backed war on drugs. The declaration by the leaders of Mexico, Belize, Honduras, and Costa Rica did not explicitly say they were considering weakening their government's efforts against cannabis smuggling, but it strongly implied the votes last week in Colorado and Washington would make enforcing marijuana bans more difficult. Oh, these people are making our ability to frickin' arm Contras and murder entire communities full of people in order to take their drugs. Oh, those bastards. Those bastards. We won't be able to enslave and kill people consistently and waste money doing so and provide money for the oil and drug barons that really work for Wall Street because that's who launders all their money. The poor dears. You know, what's a guy got to do? You're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. Come on, can we reach some kind of agreement here? Can we just, you know, ship the guns in and the drugs out or something like that? You know, this is a free trade economy, you know what I'm saying? You've got to be kidding me, man. The four called for the Organization of American States to study the impact of the Colorado and Washington votes and said the United Nations General Assembly should hold a special session on the prohibition of drugs by 2015 at the latest. Last week, the most influential advisor to Mexico's president-elect, who takes office on December 1st, questioned how the country would enforce a ban on growing and smuggling a drug that is now legal under some US states. Well, namely, if it's legal and people can get it anywhere without violating the law, you're going to have to make sure your prices comes down. So you're probably not going to try and smuggle too much into those states anymore, are you? Because it'll already be everywhere. It's like a saturated market, isn't it? That's the real clear consequence. I mean, just from a drug dealing business kind of point of view, you know, it just doesn't make sense. Why would you sell a legal substance if your business is selling illegal substances? Okay, it's just not done. The Obama administration has yet to make clear how strongly it will enforce a federal ban on marijuana that is not affected by the Colorado and Washington votes. Well, you see, the DEA, it's federally illegal. And this is an argument that I had with, I think it might have been Casper Leach, and I don't think we were arguing, we were just talking about it, but that even if a law is passed by a state to say that you can do such and such, it's banned federally. And the feds are who you're going to have to worry about, not the drug dealers. Okay, and Sheriff Richard Mack on the show once, and he said that there was a sheriff somewhere in the West, I forget which, they're an Amish community, and one of the Amish farmers was having the feds come onto his property and tell him that he couldn't sell raw milk no more. And so he had to go to the sheriff and ask him, "Sheriff, these people are going to come back and they will take my stuff if they do. So I need you to protect me, Sheriff, from the government." I remember talking to Bomber Bradbury one time. He's a left-wing climate change promoting, but anti-right-wing as well at the same time. I agree with maybe 50% of the stuff that he says. He said he was trying to, you know, talk to me about gun ban legislation and all of that kind of stuff. And he says, "There's no purpose for you to have a machine gun. There's no purpose, you know, give me a reasonable excuse why anybody would need a fully automatic assault rifle. Because if the government comes at you with fully automatic assault rifles themselves, and you ain't got one to defend yourself with, you're dead. That's why the population, I believe, needs to be almost as well armed as their military, if not better. Not so that they can run around and kill people as they please, as the propagandists would tell you. Instead, it is to ensure that you have a line in the sand that can be crossed, for which you can respond with deadly force. It is a deterrent. Most people, even in police municipalities across the United States, veterans who have been working the beat for umpteen different years, these hard-boiled individuals who read into situations, who have a knowledge of what to look for when they're looking for dangerous people, who have in 10, 15 years never pulled their gun on somebody. If they have, they haven't fired a shot. The mere production of a firearm pointed at you has an instant kind of response on somebody. Suddenly everything gets really, really serious and you don't want to argue with the wrong end of a gun because you will lose that argument. 9 times out of 10. Occasionally they'll fire warning shots, and it comes down to the point where guns prevent so much crime simply by their presence and non-use. It's just that simple. And this is what the drug war is also kind of tied into as well. There's a lot of arms and drug trafficking and trade going on all over the place. It's very, very complex. And I think I might even get into a little bit more of it after the break at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com, 218-339-8525. We'll be right back.
It's all about looking on the lighter side of genocide. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. And incidentally, the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. We talk about the medical scumbaggery and all other types of it as well. And I have a caller on the line here, and we're going to take that puppy right over here, right out, Mom. We got CB calling in from Massachusetts. What's going on, man?
Vinny, my brother. This is CB. How you doing?
Mate, I'm doing fabulously.
I love the Godfather theme there. Love it. I love it. It's brilliant.
Yeah, it is pretty exciting, isn't it?
It's very exciting, Vinny. Very exciting indeed. And I got an offer for you. You can't refuse. Oh, you were talking about gun ownership. Gun ownership in the U.S.
We can make a deal.
Can we make a deal with the gun ownership thing here, do you think?
Shoot.
Seriously, though. I'm a gun owner myself. I have a shotgun and a semi-automatic .22 for personal protection and also for occasional target practice and things of that nature. I'm not a hunter per se. But I believe in the right to bear arms, and it's covered under the Constitution. If people could remember the Constitution and try reading it once in a while, that would be spectacular on their parts, those of us citizens here in the U.S. of A. So,
it's turning into the USS of A, I've found, and you have a look at, say, these other socialist dictatorships, China, Russia, Nazi Germany, you know, so national socialism. It's socialism, bro. It ain't right wing. And what did they all do? Lastly, before they started exterminating everybody, they took their guns. It's the last thing to go. And I don't know, as a gun owner, are you acutely aware of the amount of rules that you have to follow or whatever, lest they take their guns off you? Because in New Zealand, if you so much as pop a clip that has more than 10 rounds into your weapon, hot weapon, even if it's in your own home, in your own backyard, doing shooting practice, that's illegal, and you can have all your weapons confiscated and your gun license revoked permanently.
Wow. That's not quite so stringent here. I think it may be state to state, but I can say personally that you can unload your weapon in your own private home or on your property. You cannot discharge it within 500 yards of another dwelling. But I didn't know that in New Zealand. Holy shit. Oh, excuse me. Excuse my language.
I don't know what it is about my freeing personality radio talk host, but everybody just seems to cuss like a sailor on this show.
I'm sorry. My apologies. My apologies. Wow, that is.
And I apologize to the affiliates and also the illustrious FCC, without whose regulation of free speech we would not be free.
Right. My apologies to the FCC. These are the opinions of me and not of the host.
We bow down before you, FCC. We will abide by your sacred regulations that were given to us on a tablet produced by Apple on a mountaintop of Capitol Hill.
Mm.
It's kind of a religious element, isn't it? And in terms of gun ownership in the United States, I've been led to believe that it's relatively free. Like, you know, you can waltz into a shop and just get a gun.
Vinny, the availability of guns in the United States is at an all-time high right now, and it has been for about, since post 9/11, I would say. I've got friends in other states where if I wanted to, I could ask them to get a weapon for me and I could meet with them and procure it, break it down, put it in my car, or whatever, ship it to myself, by myself, you know.
Would that be legal, though?
Well, I wouldn't go so far as to. I was just being.
Of course, we're talking about something of that nature, and it reminds me of something. Was a prominent talk radio show host and another who went to a gun show, and the other guy was asking him, you know, buy me that gun at this gun show, when there was an ATF officer right behind him, and he said, no, bro, no, that's illegal.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can get guns for other people as a gift, can't you?
Absolutely. As far as like gun shows, they've been documented throughout the last couple of years, and there are tighter constraints now in place. You do have to have a background check, and it's a 7-day background check. And I mean, if you're a legitimate person and you're not a nut and you've got a relatively clean record, then you can procure these weapons. Anything up to a high-powered semi-automatic rifle, which they still haven't, as you probably know if you've been following up, they lifted the ban on assault weapons a few years ago. And so assault weapons are back in mainstream, and the assault weapons ban is about to expire, and they're thinking about lifting it, so I don't know.
Right.
There's a lot going on there.
Well, there is, and CB, I want to thank you very much for your call. We've got another caller on the line here with a number that I don't recognize. It's a 864 area code. Hey man, how are you doing? I would love your first name and maybe the state you're calling from. That'd be cool. Even an alias?
Yes, Dr. Sean Gallagher from South Carolina. I talked to you a few months back about chiropractic.
Oh yeah, how you doing, man?
Excellent. Yeah, I love your show here. I wanted to talk about I have some friends in Colorado, and they were just telling me about the marijuana thing there, and it's totally recreational now, and they're kind of celebrating about it. But what you were saying earlier, the feds still can technically come in, you know, and that's still an issue. And it's interesting, I had read an article a few months back about some of these presidents of the countries you mentioned, Belize, Nicaragua, Honduras, Guatemala. They don't like the fact that these people are smuggling drugs through their country and all the violence that's going on there. And from what these articles expressed, basically the DEA, or, you know, the federal government of America, they won't even allow the presidents of those countries to make drugs legal. That's how much power the United States has upon the presidents of these countries.
Well, in your position, as somebody who has some kind of basically a medical interest in this, as well as other people who are living within the state, would this impact your business or your kind of way of life at all, if perhaps it was legalized in your area?
It wouldn't have. Well, if it was legal in my area, I truly believe that alcohol consumption would go down and prescription drug use would go down. The real reason it's illegal is because the pharmaceutical industry wants to sell their drugs, and the alcohol industry, they lobby hard every year. The police organizations, they rally to make it legal, or you know, they lobby to make it legal, illegal every year. Pardon me. So, but I think it's the pharmaceutical number one. And alcohol, and then you also have the, you know, the fuel. I mean, Ford actually made a car completely made out of hemp material and used hemp to fuel his cars, and out of his own hemp fields that Ford owned. So it's a lot of it's with the oil as well.
Well, and again, this is the argument I had earlier, is that it's not gone full legalization, including the industrial hemp. They're just doing it for recreational use. But it's a good point that you make about alcohol and pharmaceutical drugs. I mean, how many people are currently going into hospitals with illnesses or alcohol addiction or anything of that nature, for which they could be properly prescribed, safe, medical grade, all checked, all tested cannabis for their ailments? And how much of a profit incentive would there be for that doctor to prescribe said things if he's getting kickbacks from the pharmaceutical industry, if he's a paid lobbyist for the alcohol cartel?
Exactly. Now, let's think about it, too. Let's be realistic here, very realistic. The Native Indians, for thousands of years, they've been chewing on the coca leaves. And, you know, most synthetic drugs, they're either considered like an upper or downer. And you could, like the Adderall and the Ritalin they're feeding our children, that's the class A amphetamine, the same class as cocaine, according to AMA. Now, if you could, imagine if you could ideally grow coca leaves in your own home and chew on it or make a tea out of it. You could grow opium in your own home. You could grow marijuana in your own home. How many people would be, you know, buying Adderall or you know, OxyContin if they could just grow it at home for free? Or, you know, even if you want to have a couple of beers, grow your own alcohol at home. You know, but they don't want that. They want it. They want it where you buy it from them. I mean, like, how much safer, Vinny, how much safer would it be for a human, like an adult male, say 35, to consume opium tea or to shoot heroin?
Well, here's another thing. You know, ladies and gentlemen, think about this for a moment. Have you ever tried weed before? Yes. Did you instantly want to try heroin right after that? No.
No, I mean, let's think about this, too. If you had, say, 10 college students in a little experiment all lined up, and out of the 10, 5 were drunk and 5 were on marijuana, and you place cocaine in front of all 10 of them, which ones would do the cocaine and which ones wouldn't? The ones on cannabis or the ones that were on alcohol? I would have to say that the odds would go way up that the ones on alcohol would do the cocaine or the heroin.
Well, hold on a second. Have you ever treated somebody who had a problem with prescription drugs or a problem with alcohol?
Oh, definitely. I've had a lot of patients are hooked on a lot of different drugs. And
Okay. Hold on. And have you ever treated anybody who had a dependence on marijuana?
No, I mean, they may have been dependent on it, but it was never an issue for them, that's for sure.
I rest my case.
No, I'm just a big advocate of people being able to do what they want to do in the privacy of their own home. The government should not be able to tell anybody what they can or cannot put in their own body, period. And if you want to do something, it should be done in its most natural, purest state, not a synthetic version.
Well, and also, what are the causes of drug dependence and drug abuse in the first place? I mean, for example, when I was really badly drug dependent, it was because I was in the workforce working as a salesman when I didn't want to be in the workforce. I didn't want to be a salesman. I was doing something I didn't want to do, and I wasn't becoming the person I wanted to become. And so I had to find a way to drown out my my wants and my needs with drugs and alcohol every weekend because I couldn't stand the situation I was in. But because I got out of that, that problem went away. You know, if you were a guitarist and you were depressed and you instead of taking your prescription meds started really working hardcore on your music, would you still need those drugs if you had 10,000 screaming fans in front of you to stop you from being depressed? Hell no, because you'd be where you wanted to be and you'd be doing what you were meant to be doing. So there's psychological and situational and career aspects that come into the fold whenever you're doing any kind of escapism. And if you're not actually escaping, if you're simply dulling the pain of being where you are, there is no amount that you can consume that will stop that problem. It's an infinite self-destructive cycle, and it ain't worth it. And the solution's simple. Are you happy with your life? No. Well, then you've got to do something to change it, not drown out the body and the mind and the soul so that you can just kind of ignore them while you go about your daily, annoying, meaningless, fruitless life. That's the reason why people get depressed, in my opinion. Sean, thank you very much. Dr. Sean Gallagher, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back after the break. Sean, thank you for your call.
The flight to New Zealand by plane from New York City, it takes 22 hours. So from the Twin Cities, 19. I mean, I fly all the time, and 6 hours on a plane is like a lot, and 19 is wrong. And they distract you. They feed you, and then they feed you some more, and then they feed you, give me a dessert. Have your dessert, you prick, give me that dessert. Have a Bloody Mary, yeah, give me a whiskey sour, yeah, give me whatever you got. Just more liquor. And then when you're done, there's still 16 hours to go. If you want to know what it's like, you can experience going to New Zealand. It's very simple. Sit in a chair for 19 hours and take your hands and press your head as hard as you can. And don't stop. Don't stop. 19 hours, just like this. And then at the end of 19 hours, you pull your hands off and you feel like you're in New Zealand. You certainly won't feel like you're home. They say that New Zealand's beautiful, and I don't know because by the time I got over the jet lag, I had to go. And it seems to me if you're going to travel for 19 hours to another country, when you get there, they should have the common courtesy to speak another language. I did not fly all this way to hear English again.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the lighter side of genocide, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. New Zealand, speaking of drug prescriptions and something like this, here's an article here from the New Zealand Press. Many New Zealanders are not getting free prescriptions they are entitled to, and the most vulnerable are likely to be hardest hit when charges rise next year, researchers warn. Most people say $3 per medicine at the pharmacy, and after members of a family have paid for 20 prescription items in a year, all of them should be exempt from the charge. But Pharmac data show 180,000 people pay for prescriptions after becoming exempt, costing them about $2.5 million a year. Where do they get the money for all these prescriptions? Oh, yeah, that's right. The government does deal with the major evil frickin' pharmaceutical cartels so that they can push all these drugs on the public in their third stage trials to see what it actually does.
because they have no evidence that they're safe or effective. A study into prescription use by researchers at Otago University and Wellington's Victoria University, led by Professor Pauline Norris, shows those are affected likely to include the country's most vulnerable people, who instead of probably using prescription drugs, should be getting themselves probably herbal remedies, naturopathy, or drinking a hell of a lot more water, or eating fresh fruit and vegetables, and they'll find out that all these problems in their life will start to disappear, because they'll be now capable of thinking and their body will now be capable of repairing themselves. But instead, what we'll do is we'll just dope them up so that they can't even do anything except pull donuts drooling out the window with the system up. Using anonymous data from community pharmacy computers, researchers identified individuals who had more than 20 items dispensed in a year and found most were from socioeconomically deprived areas. A total of 40% of patients still paid the prescription fee for 90% of the medicines they received, despite being exempt. So here's the problem. A whole bunch of people who are entitled to stuff and have a sense of entitlement, who have no economic prospects really, need more free stuff that everybody else has to pay for in order to solve these problems which never get solved, only keep getting paid for. Who winds up with all this money at the end of the day? Who winds up cured at the end of the day? Who winds up better off at the end of the day? And the answer is none of the people that would get free medication in a lot of cases. Standard charges for prescription medicines are due to rise from $3 to $5 in January. Professor Norris, Chuck Norris that is, said the exemption meant families should not be required to pay more than $100 a year after the increases come in, but many people didn't know about the prescription subsidy card needed to get the exemption, or they had to use one main pharmacy and give receipts from others. That's out of the Otago Daily Times. Moving on, Sue Kedgley, I've had on the show before, I think you can sue her. Clean green image hides a dark reality. Imported supplements threat to tropical rainforests and a concern for consumers and export trade. News that New Zealand cows are being fed genetically modified soy and cottonseed meal has come as a shock to many consumers who imagined our dairy cows were happily chomping away on an exclusive diet of lush green grass. It will be even more of a shock, I suspect, to overseas consumers who have seen advertisements claiming our cows are fed lush green grass year-round, and who assume that dairy cows reared in clean New Zealand would not be fed genetically modified feed. But it turns out our so-called grass-fed cows are being fed more supplementary feed from a variety of sources. As dairying has become ever more intensive with more cows per hectare, the industry claims that cows need to be fed more than just grass to produce the large quantities of milk the industry demands. And so the industry has been quietly importing palm kernel, a byproduct of palm oil. Last year, we imported 1.5 million tons of palm kernel from Malaysia, Indonesia, Papua New Guinea, and Singapore to feed dairy cows. These imports are helping to destroy the tropical rainforest in Southeast Asia and the habitats of endangered species such as the orangutan. They are also helping to destroy the grain industry in New Zealand. Many grain farmers who could supply alternative feed for dairy cattle have been unable to compete with the cheap palm kernel imports and have gone out of business. This is bad enough, but now it turns out the dairy industry has also been quietly importing substantial quantities of soy and cottonseed meal, which is almost certainly genetically engineered to feed to our dairy cows. In the last few years, several hundred thousand tons of soybean and cottonseed meal have been imported, mostly from Argentina, where almost all soybean crops are genetically engineered, Indonesia and Australia, where most of the cottonseed is genetically engineered. According to the farm newspaper, Straight Furrow, an entire shipment of genetically engineered cottonseed landed in Timaru recently, destined for dairy herds in the South Island. Look at it this way, ladies and gentlemen. If somebody tells you something, and they're expecting you to buy something from them as a result of what they've told you, there's a distinct possibility that they might be, oh yeah, that's lying to you. That's what happens all the time. You know what this article teaches me? I even was operating under the suspicion that there'd be plenty of GMOs here in the New Zealand food chain already, and yet I'm still buying meat at we're still getting meat at the supermarket because we can't really afford organic meat or whatever. And you know what I've decided now, just after reading even half of that article, I'm going to have to start buying organic meat.
and I'm going to have to cut myself off at the knees in order to survive even worse, because I don't want my DNA to be corrupted by a bunch of corrupt DNA manipulating fracks that are fracking with the food chain. I don't want to support it. Don't want to give them my money. Even if it costs me more to get an alternative that is safe. And even then, how would I know? They could be feeding 10% genetically modified material into the mouths of these organic cows and all of that kind of stuff. The food's not safe unless you know where it comes from. Have you seen the cow? Did you see the farm? Did you see the spring where that water you bought came from? No, no, and no. Have you got a back garden? Did you pick that celery or that lettuce leaf or that spring onion yourself? No, no, and no. I don't know where our food is coming from. We don't know what's in it. And we don't know what kind of price variation is going to go on this. It occurs to me that I'm much like the rest of the public. Utterly dependent. You know, like a tripod, you know, you kick out one of my legs, I'm going to go tumbling. It's kind of reason why I do this show as well, is because I need support from people just to get through. So if you're capable of supporting this show financially at all, we're looking for people who would like to sell their products. We're looking for people who would like to donate small contributions every month, $5, $10, $20 a month. The subscription button's there on the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Those small contributions that I've been getting have actually been capable of paying near on every bill I've been getting for the last 4 or 5 months. I think been very, very slowly gaining the ability to survive without ridiculous amounts of stress. But yet it's still not covering everything. And whenever I have more than I need, I wind up getting new equipment or better stuff, or I'll put some extra work into designing some new DVDs or whatever. I feel like I must earn it. So if you can support the show, please do. Go to the VinnieEastwoodShow.com and scroll down a little bit, find the donate button or the subscribe button. Very much appreciate it. And if you do want to have a chat with me and the listeners, please add us on Skype. Vincent.Eastwood. Vincent.Eastwood is my Skype name. You add me as a contact there, and you just tell me that you want to be part of the social chat. I'll add you into the group. And after the show, every day, more or less every day, we'll have conversations with you, sometimes with the guests and whatnot. So Vincent.Eastwood on Skype, just add me there, flick me a message, and I'll bring you into the call, which should be starting in about 5 minutes from now if you're listening in live. So thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for tuning into this particular episode. And I hope that your food, your guns, and your weed are safe and snuggly. And I also wanted to point out that if you've got a problem with your government, or if you've got a problem with the world around you, it's kind of like I forget who it was. I think it might have been Alan Abadesa Green that told me, you know, there's a chair on the other end of this room, and I want that chair to be right beside me so you can sit next to me. There's two ways I could do that. I'd be real clever about it, go away to some monastery and practice telekinesis for about 60 years, come back, and then move the chair. Or I could just get up and move the chair. It'd take 2 seconds, you know? Quickest possible route. It doesn't mean that the easiest way is always the correct way, but be logical about it, you know? You got a problem in front of you? Solve it if you can. And if you can't, start thinking about it. Think about it until you can solve it. That's all I'm saying. I'll be right back after the break. No.